The Epistle to the Hebrews constitutes one of the most difficult sections of Bible for those of us who have embraced a Messianic Jewish perspective. Thankfully, D. Thomas Lancaster, First Fruits of Zion's Director of Education, has spent years penning a commentary which will enrich and enlighten you. He's here today to give us a sneak peek, and I trust that you'll find his insights helpful.
Put your hand in mine together. We will walk in harmony. Let me introduce you to my teacher, the rabbi from the Galilee.
You're listening to Messiah Podcast, where Jesus is Jewish and that changes everything. Messiah Podcast is a production of First Fruits of Zion. Well, welcome back to Messiah Podcast, and we're here with D. Thomas Lancaster. He's the Director of Education for First Fruits of Zion, and you have a new book out, and it's a commentary on the Epistle to the Hebrews. So I want to explore the context for this commentary. So you're like a pastor, right?
Yeah, I like that, sort of analogous to a pastor. I'm part of a Messianic Jewish synagogue, so the title pastor doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really fit so well, but I'm certainly not a rabbi in any sense. You know, we've used awkward, like, kind of monikers, like, or, you know, like congregational leader, which doesn't fit well on a business card. But, you know, what I do, I teach here. This is the thing. I'm a teacher. I teach here. And I've been doing that for about 21 years, something like that.
Nice. So recently you did a thing on the Epistle to the Hebrews.
Right. Well, no. Recently being like in 2010. So no, it's not been so recent. It's been a while. No. Yeah, I taught through the entire Epistle to the Hebrews, and this is my second run at it. The first run was back in 2003. And so then I wanted to return to the material to develop some of these exciting ideas a little bit further. And I spent about a year with the congregation working through the epistle, you know, just verse by verse, really, just, you know, chapter by chapter, working through the epistle together from a Messianic Jewish perspective. And I mean, we had a lot of fun with it. It was, oh, I did sure. Anyway, I don't know if the people sitting up, have, you know, forced to listen to me had a lot of fun, but I had a lot of fun teaching through the epistle, at that pace and, you know, to spend a year, like really dipping in. So that was a long time ago. That's like 14 years ago. And I always intended to, you know, to package this work up in one of these books. You know, I did one on Galatians. Look. Uh-huh. Here.
Yeah.
Oh, Holy I love Epistle that. Galatians. Of the Galatians. Yeah. Based on teachings presented at the synagogue, Beth Emmanuel Messianic Synagogue. That was a series. And so these are the subtitle is Sermons on a Messianic Jewish Approach. Then there's this one.
Ephesians.
Newer. Yeah. Ephesians. Yeah. And so I just taught through Ephesians a couple years ago. So same thing, Sermons on a Messianic Jewish Approach, being an approach to the epistle. And then here's this work from 2010, but this is just the first volume of two, because this one only covers chapters 1 through 7. With God's help, we'll release the rest of it, you know, within the next 12 months. It's pretty much all written. It's just waiting to get packaged up, you know?
Yeah. You've done the hard work.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. And you've been a part of this process as well, because we pay you money to actually read my work to help me polish the writing.
Don't give everybody the secret sauce. Yeah. Yeah. I go through some stuff. You know who's the real hero in all of this is Candy Bishop. She just goes ahead and she,
yeah, I know.
I don't know how she does it, but
yeah, it's amazing.
She's incredible.
She's our proofreader. You know, there's like before Candy Bishop and after Candy Bishop. And before Candy Bishop, it was like all of our work was just riddled with typos. And so, shout out to Candy.
So, You know what? Like the deepest wish of my heart is to move to where you are and like listen to you talk every week.
That sounds achievable. Look at my mug here.
Yeah.
I got the I came home to Hudson mug like that I'm drinking my tea out of. You too could be the proud owner of one of these mugs, Jacob.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe it will happen for me. But I don't think everybody knows the how special Beth Emanuel is. And so maybe you could take a second and just sure. sort of tell our listeners what's like how special and how good the thing is that you're doing there in Hudson, Wisconsin.
I think everyone is special and every congregation is special to begin with, but
not we're as a little much different. As you.
Yeah. Some are more special than others. I didn't know. Yeah. So I might be a little biased, about Beth Emanuel, but what makes it unique, and put it that way, what makes us different than most Messianic Jewish congregations is that you really do have like an expression of an Orthodox Messianic Judaism happening here at Beth Emanuel. So it's it's, you know, halakhic Jews living halakhically Jewish lives in community together and, you know, trying to form a minyan and, you know, which we're able to do, thank God, pretty regularly and doing a completely halakhically orthodox synagogue service together on a regular basis. So that's, I think that's what makes us a little different. You know, so it's like you go to a Messianic Jewish congregation, ordinarily you can expect sort of a charismatic treatment of a synagogue service, you know, with some you know, kind of like a Maranatha Hillsong mashup vibe with some liturgy. And so we're not like that.
There's just not too many places where you can
there's
go
not a
and
lot.
Get this.
Right. There's not a lot. And there's a reason for that. It's not something that appeals to most people. You know, it's like a full-on Hebrew liturgy and full-on Hebrew Torah reading it takes a special kind of person to want to participate on a regular basis.
Yeah. Sign me up. But you're right. So you took like a year going through the Epistle to the Hebrews, one of the more difficult books of the New Testament, to interpret from a Messianic Jewish perspective, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And we have this and it's not because of any content inherent to the book itself, but it's just been like it's gotten a raw deal, right? It's been misinterpreted. So maybe you can give our listeners, like a broad spectrum sort of what is the Epistle to the Hebrews and what's going on there?
Okay. It is, like you said, you know, it's difficult to interpret from a Messianic Jewish perspective because, you know, it's like until we really understood the approach of Paul within Judaism and distinction theology and that Paul is talking to Gentiles and not, you know, he's not addressing a Jewish audience when he's, you know, warning about, you know, works of the law or whatever he's speaking.
Yeah.
Until we understood
James Dunn figured that out.
Right on. So until we had these pieces in place, I mean, there was a universal misinterpretation of Paul in the church for most of the last 2,000 years. Right. And we're still just emerging from that. Well, Hebrews is not, you know, Hebrews has its own, it's been similarly misunderstood for most of 2,000 years. And so there's this overarching like paradigm of interpretation, the replacement theology and idea that rules the way that Hebrews is understood and interpreted within Christianity and has been for most of the time we've had the Epistle to the Hebrews. But if you step back from that, you step back from that misunderstanding of Paul, first of all, and then you say, okay, well, perhaps we've also similarly misunderstood the Epistle to the Hebrews. How would we understand this book if we assumed that it's in concert with the teachings of Yeshua, the teachings of Jesus regarding when he says things like, don't think that I've come to abolish the Torah until heaven and earth disappear, not the least stroke of a pen or the smallest jot or tittle are going to in any way disappear from the Torah. how would that work with Hebrews, where it appears that the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying the temple is canceled, it's replaced by the heavenly temple, the priesthood is canceled, it's replaced by the priesthood of Messiah, the sacrifices are canceled, they're replaced by the sacrifice of the Messiah, the old covenant is canceled, it's replaced by the new covenant. You know, you go on and on and on. It's like, oh, look at this. This is ground zero of replacement theology. So that's what's made it so difficult for us to assess and address squarely from a Messianic Jewish perspective. Okay, so that's the challenge.
So someone out there is you, because you're talking about Paul, and there is this sort of, there is a tradition in the Christian church that maybe Paul wrote this book. And he definitely didn't.
Yeah, correct. You got it. There is a tradition that he maybe wrote it. There's a tendency for people to want it to be Paul because Paul's their favorite.
Yeah.
You know. But there is this there was some hope back even in the early days of when they were putting the canon together that maybe it was Paul, that maybe Paul wrote like, in Hebrew. And
why else is it in the Bible? Everyone's looking for an apostolic connection for the canon, right?
Right.
And it's like, if Paul didn't write Hebrews, then why do we have it? But it's very good. Like, I love Hebrews. However, it's not Pauline, right?
It's not Pauline text. I mean, we know that from several angles. We know it's not Pauline text just from the style of the Greek. The Greek is really good. The Greek is polished. It's not like Paul's.
Paul. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's just not, that's not his writing style. The argumentation style is not Pauline. The fact that the writer of the book of Hebrews, the exhortation, that is the epistle to the Hebrews, doesn't use the first person pronoun until the very end of the epistle. That's not Pauline. Yeah. If Paul's writing, he's writing from that first person perspective. All the way through.
He's very self-aware.
Yeah, put it that way. So it's definitely not Paul. And I think another approach that the people who would like it to be Paul, they're also camping on this idea of, well, Paul cancels the Torah in his writings, and this the Apostle of the Hebrews also cancels the Torah in its. So there's that kind of mashup, some sort of conflation that's happening theologically in their heads.
Yeah, for
sure. But it's not Paul. You're right. It's not Paul.
Yeah. Do we know who it is? Like, what's your favorite theory?
My favorite theory. My favorite theory, this is how I would put it. It's not an apostle. We know it's not an apostle because the writer of the book of Hebrews refers to the apostles as those from whom we received the word.
So
that puts him into a second generation that is a disciple of the apostles. So my favorite theory, and this is something that's, I didn't make this theory up. This is from the church fathers. You can find this in Eusebius. It might have been Clement of Alexandria. It slips my mind right now who first offered this tradition, is that this was written by Clement, the disciple of Peter, Clement of Rome, the author of the Clement's first epistle to the Corinthians, the same author. But that's the weakness of that idea is that it's based primarily on what might be just Clement quoting from the epistle to the Hebrews. But the strength of the idea is that, well, even if it's not Clement, Clement fits the bill really well geographically, because we're speaking about Rome. We're speaking of like greetings to the believers in Rome at the end of the epistle. And Clement is a second generation. He's a disciple of the apostles. So he's someone close to the apostles, and he's also someone who speaks with the voice of authority of the apostles in that he's one of the top disciples. So he was ordained, so to speak. Peter laid hands on him according to church tradition. So it's and the writer of the book of Hebrews speaks with that level of authority as he's writing. So my favorite my favorite theory on authorship of the Epistle to the Hebrews is someone like Clement of Rome. I'm not saying it's Clement of Rome. I'm saying it's someone like Clement of Rome. The other thing about Clement of Rome is that, according to tradition, he's part of the Pauline school as well. He's even though he's Peter's disciple, he has contact with the Pauline school. And the Epistle of the Hebrews makes reference to Timothy, right? And so that it tells us that this is someone within the Pauline school, and that, you know, Clement could possibly fit that bill well. So there
if
you
it's
go.
Not Clement, it's someone just like that.
That's what I'm saying.
So let's dive into a little bit of exegesis here, because when you open Hebrews, it just sort of looks like this compare and contrast thing, right? It's like, oh, back then this is how it was, and now this is how it is now.
Right.
Before God revealed himself in this way, and now he's revealing himself in a different way.
Right.
And maybe you can clarify for our listeners.
Yeah.
What's happening there in the first chapter of Hebrews?
Okay. So in the first chapter of Hebrews, in the opening words of Hebrews, where he says, you know, in the past God spoke to our fathers through the prophets, you know, in various and sundry ways and so forth. But in these last days, he's spoken to us through his son, you know, through the son. That could be understood from a replacement theology perspective to say, in the past, God spoke through the writers of the Old Testament, but now he speaks only through Jesus. And so the revelation that comes to us through Jesus replaces that of the Tanakh. But that's certainly not the intention of the writer of the epistle. Instead, the intention of the writer of the epistle is to elevate the revelation of Yeshua by building on top of the revelation that came through the Torah, through the prophets, through the writings, and to say, look, this is all emanating from the same God. And then he goes on to develop this idea of saying, and if the Torah was given through the angel of the Lord, through angels, if the Torah that was given through angels came with such severe consequences for its violation that, you know, you can be put to death for breaking the commandments of the Torah, then how much more so should we be paying attention to the revelation that's coming to us through the Son, who isn't speaking just about this present world, but he's speaking to us about the world to come. He's speaking to us about repentance for attaining the kingdom and the age to come. And that is the whole idea of the Epistle of Hebrews is, do not let go of your allegiance to Yeshua of Nazareth, because he is the ticket to entrance into the Messianic era, the kingdom, and the world to come. And you know, don't forfeit that. Don't forfeit that by turning away from him or growing lax in your devotion to him.
Yeah.
That's the idea. If you get that much out of the Epistle of Hebrews, that's all he was really trying to communicate.
Yeah. Again, there's a lot of things we take for granted when we read the New Testament. We don't necessarily understand what everybody was going through at that time.
So, okay. So my premise is that Hebrews was written in the early 60s, not the 1960s, but the 60s, which is a time period in which the disciples of Yeshua had fallen under increasing pressure from the religious establishment, specifically the Sadducean religious establishment. That is the household of Hananiah ben Seth, that's Annas in the New Testament, and Caiaphas, the culprits from the Gospels.
Yeah, yeah. Real bad guys.
Because they deny the resurrection of the dead. And so they really have it out for the disciples of Yeshua, because they're basing their whole thing on the resurrection of the dead, both the resurrection of Yeshua and also the resurrection in the age to come. That's their big message. So they have it out for them. And so we have these persecutions that break out in the 60s. And you have to understand, these people control the temple. This is the priesthood.
It's a big
and
deal.
They have financial, political, and religious control over who can access the temple. And so my premise is that they have essentially issued a threat to put the disciples on the ban if they don't renounce. And this would be a catastrophic situation for Jewish people in the first century before the destruction of the temple to be told, oh, you won't have access to the temple any longer. It's like, what? You know, the temple is the center. It's the center of our faith. This is where the God of Israel reveals himself and through the temple and through the priesthood and through the ministrations that are happening and through the sacrificial services. This is the source of God. You know, this is the vector for God's blessing as he outpours his blessing upon the nation of Israel. And this is towards the temple. That's where we direct our prayers. You know, we turn towards Jerusalem when we pray, like Daniel did in Babylon. To be told by the high priesthood that you're on the ban, that you don't have access to the temple unless you renounce your allegiance to this Yeshua of Nazareth. I think that's what's going on here. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews is writing and saying, look, I realize that, this is the temptation is to backpedal and to say, well, you know, maybe he is the Messiah, maybe he isn't the Messiah.
Yeah, maybe
not. that kind of thing. But he's like, his entire point is, look, the temple on earth is a reflection of the heavenly temple. The priesthood on earth is a reflection of the heavenly priesthood. So he's not suggesting that one replaces the other. He's saying these are different venues. So the heavenly temple, this is the temple for the world to come. Likewise, the new covenant is the covenant for the messianic era and leading us into the age to come. Whereas the old covenant, as he terms it, right? The first covenant is what he really says.
Yeah,
the first covenant is. It endures as long as this age endures, like Yeshua said, until heaven and earth disappear. But the writer of the book of Hebrews says, but heaven and earth is disappearing, and it's about to disappear. It's quickly, it's growing old, it's fading, it's becoming obsolete. Heaven and earth are what's becoming, is what's fading and becoming obsolete. So we need to be concerned with the age to come and not just this age. So don't forfeit your high priest and your sacrifice and your access to the temple in heaven and the age to come for the sake of this present world. That is the main thrust of the Epistle to the Hebrews. And he even states this right at the outset. He says, for it's not to angels that the world to come was given, and it's the world to come that we're speaking about. That's what we're talking about. So you have to know from the outset of the epistle what it is we're talking about. We're talking about the age to come, the messianic era, the age to come, after which we enter into Olam Haba, which is eternal life, the resurrection of the dead, and eternal life.
You mentioned this there's this dichotomy in Hebrews, right? With between the old covenant and the new covenant. And this is an issue that, you know, I like in my Torah club, and everybody is just like, seems to be confused about this, because you have this, you know, in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you have this new covenant and it's with the people of Israel. And then here we are, right? You and me,
right?
We're not Israelites.
No, you and me, we're like the token Gentiles
on
staff at First Fruits of Zion.
Exactly. Hebrews goes into this like in great detail, like painfully, just sort of talking about this. The old covenant is passing away and the new covenant is here. At the same time, it's like, oh, this is the Epistle to the Hebrews. I'm not a Hebrew. What have you to say to all of us out there who are not Hebrews, who are
sort of
trying to find our place in this thing?
Okay, well, that's really a great question. To begin with, I think it's important to differentiate between this age and the age to come, and to understand that we are not in the age to come yet. And so as long as we're not in the age to come, according to the book of Hebrews, the first covenant is still in place. So the Torah is still in place. All the commandments are still in place. But those, of course, that's, you know, more of a Jewish concern.
Yeah, yeah. We're playing by Sinai rules. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, we're still playing by Sinai rules. The new covenant, according to the book of Hebrews, which is just quoting Jeremiah, so according to the prophet Jeremiah, is for the age to come. That's for the coming messianic era, at which time he's going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. He's going to remove the sin and the iniquity of the house of Israel and the house of Judah. He's going to establish the nation of Judah and Israel. He's going to recreate the people so that everybody in the nation will know the Lord. And no one needs to say to his neighbor, "Know ye the Lord," for they will all know him from the least to the greatest. This is the new covenant. This absolutely has not happened yet. This, yeah. We are absolutely not there yet. This is so you know, people say, well, we're under the new covenant now. It's like, well, that would be nice, but no. The new covenant is the covenant for the age to come, for sure. And we're looking forward to that. But your question, how do we fit into that? That is a question that the Epistle to the Hebrews does not address. That is not even interested in this. In answering your question, because that's not who he's, this is not Paul. That's not Paul writing. And Paul, you know, which I should have mentioned, you know, when we were talking about authorship, how else do we know it's not Paul? Because he doesn't talk about the nations.
Yeah.
He doesn't talk about the Gentiles. So if you want to know how Gentiles fit into this covenant relationship, you know what? I'm sorry. This is not your book. Try this one, okay? You got Ephesians, you got Galatians. Yeah, yeah. This is where you're going to have to go for that material. And of course, the answer being that Paul is going to say, through our relationship with the King of Israel, Yeshua of Nazareth, we become servants, so to speak, of the King of Israel. I like to think of us like as a conquered people, like, you know, when the King of Israel takes over the world, you know, he conquers the nations, right? And then he takes captives. We are those captives of King Messiah. We've surrendered to the King. This is how Paul presents it. And so then, through this faith, this Abrahamic faith of the promised King of King Messiah, we're grafted into this whole economy of the covenants. So in Ephesians, he says, you were strangers to the covenants prior to faith in Messiah, and foreigners, but now you've been brought near. So that's the answer, is our relationship to the new covenant is only through holding on to King Messiah and riding in on his coattails, so to speak, to saying, I'm with him. I'm with Yeshua of Nazareth, and my allegiance is with him as king, and that's our point of entry into what's called the new covenant. How's that?
No, that's good. There's this whole like hermeneutical problem, right? Where like I'm not a Thessalonian, I'm not a Corinthian, and I'm not a Hebrew, so it's like a, you know, like my address is not on the envelope. Like there's so much there. Oh. For us to learn from and glean from, and that's it's inspired and it's good.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, like, we've been blind carbon copied on this. Does that make sense?
Exactly. I mean, when you say epistle, an epistle is a letter, and a letter is addressed to someone, and it's frankly, it's not addressed to us. And so it comes with this whole worldview and this set of assumptions and that we're missing. And that missing context, then, if we're just left trying to construe what's going on from the epistle itself, from the letter itself, it's completely possible to come to completely wrong ideas. So, you know, you need the broader context. And what is the broader context? The broader context to interpreting this stuff is Judaism. That is the missing piece, specifically an apocalyptic understanding of Judaism. And by apocalyptic, I mean that this current age is coming to an end. And the Messiah is going to, he's going to usher in the Messianic era and the kingdom that's ultimately going to bring us into the world to come, the final judgment in the world to come. That is the, that is the Jewish perspective behind all of the epistles in the New Testament. And if you have that in place, oh, it just gets so much easier. The other thing you have to have in place is this idea of distinction, that Jews are not Gentiles and Gentiles are not Jews, and faith in Jesus does not make Gentiles into Jews, and it does not make Jews into Gentiles. You get those two things. If you have those two things in place, you'll do okay.
Yeah. All right. So I want to zoom in a little bit here on Hebrews talks about the Levitical priesthood a lot, right?
A lot.
Someone could charitably find themselves confused to think that Hebrews is deprecating the Levitical system and all of the sacrifices and so forth.
Right.
You have carved out a different path, which I think is valuable and helpful. Can you enlighten us as to what that is?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a hermeneutical argument, a piece of standard rabbinic hermeneutics, actually, that underlies all of the discussions in Hebrews. And in Hebrew, we call that kal vechomer, okay? And kal vechomer literally means from the light to the weighty or to the heavy, from the light matter to the heavy. So, you know, a fortiori is a people are more familiar with.
It exists in other systems, but
But specifically in Judaism, and this gets used all the time in Judaism, this it works out like this. You even have this right in the Torah, this kind of argument, and Moses employs it. He says, you know, God wants to send him to Pharaoh, and Moses goes, the Jewish people have not listened to me. How much more so is Pharaoh not going to listen to me? You know, how much less would Pharaoh listen to me? If my own people won't listen to me, you know, what are the chances that this pagan king is going to listen to me, right? And so the idea is you take the one matter, and if the one matter is true and certain, then it should lead to, like, the next thing you propose should obviously be true based on the first, okay?
Yeah.
That's the idea. And so we find this method all through rabbinic literature. It's just very common. And it runs all through the book of Hebrews. It's just over and over and over again. So, you know, I already mentioned, right in the first chapter, you've got, if the message spoken by angels, you know, was, you know, weighty and had, you know, you need to pay attention to this. How much more so, if God is speaking from heaven through his son today, do we need to be paying attention? Do we need to heed him?
I think people miss that, right? It's like,
oh yeah.
People read that and they're like, oh, they think angels are not like any good. And it's like, oh no, this is really good.
Yeah, exactly. So it totally destroys the logic of the argument all the way through the book of Hebrews if you think that it's the one is replacing the other. Instead, what you're doing is you're establishing the weight of the first thing. And you're saying, yeah, but you know what? Even though that's weighty, that's light compared to this second thing that I'm saying. And so if you're in with me on the weight of the first thing, you better be in with me on the weight of the second thing.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
He does that in you know, chapter 12 regarding the two mountains. You've got Mount Sinai, you know, where God spoke in the thunder and the lightning and everybody was quaking with fear. And it was such a terrifying experience. And God said that not even an animal could touch the mountain or die. And even Moses' knees were knocking together, you know. And then on the other hand, you've got Mount Zion, where it says, where, you know, there's thousands upon thousands, myriad angels have, you know, and he goes on with all of this description of the age to come, of the Messianic era and the age to come. The idea there is not that the one has replaced the other. The idea there is, like, if Mount Sinai, which is part of this world, which is fading away, which is passing away, which is just temporary, if Mount Sinai was awesome, How much more so awesome is Mount Zion of the Messianic future? Right? So yeah. We find that running all through the epistle, that same progression of logic runs all through the epistle. So the sacrifices, he talks about the sacrifice. He says, if the blood and bulls and goats was efficacious to sanctify for the purification of the flesh, of the body, here in this world, how much more so will the blood of the Messiah be efficacious to clear the conscience for the world to come, to clear the person, to cleanse the person for the spiritual cleansing for the resurrection in the world to come? Or again, if the Aaronic priesthood, you know, the priesthood that ministers, Aaron and his sons who minister daily in the temple for the annual remission of sins, he's speaking about Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, how much more so this one sacrifice that the Messiah has made when he has entered not into the Holy of Holies on earth, but into the Holy of Holies of the heavenly temple, of which the temple on earth is only a shadow and a reflection. So that's the idea. That's the logical progression. And it runs through the whole epistle. And people don't get that. They think the first thing is being deprecated in order to elevate the second thing, but that's not it. The first thing is being established as being reliable and true in order to make the case for the weightier matter.
Yeah, yeah. You do have to like trust the Bible. You have to trust that that's like the gold standard, right?
Yep. Yep.
You can't like veer from that path in any way. Like God does not say, "Oh, I was confused" or whatever. Like
right. Right. No. God doesn't change. God is not a man that he should lie.
Exactly.
Yep. God doesn't change. So if we have this initial revelation, you know, it's not going to get scratched. Like, yeah, it didn't work. Let me try something else. That doesn't work at all. And, you know, if that would be creating a new religion, you know, that would be to say, okay, let's start a new religion and just forget everything and disconnect the Old Testament because we got a new thing now. And of course, that's the way a lot of people look at the New Testament, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
That's how you end up with a religion called Christianity, actually, is based on that type of thinking. But that's not consistent with Jewish thought. It's not consistent with biblical thought. It's certainly not consistent with the thought of the apostles who build the entire edifice of this faith, this particular faith in Yeshua, upon the revelation of God through the scriptures that came to us by Moses and the prophets, that is, the scriptures of Israel. So you cannot build, on the one hand, you cannot prove your case that Yeshua is the Messiah and we should acknowledge him as such. You cannot prove that case on the basis of the scriptures of Israel while simultaneously saying that the scriptures of Israel are no longer valid.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real catch-22, right?
I mean,
it only works if you take it all as it is.
That's it. That's it. Exactly. You've got to take it all.
I remember like the moment that it came to me. It's like the Old Testament's in the Bible for a reason.
Yeah. The Old Testament's in the Bible.
Like Marcion lost, okay? And he should have lost, and that was good lost.
That's right.
And like Baruch Hashem that this was all preserved for us.
It is a miracle. You know, and I have to, like, a lot of times, you know, maybe people listening to us think, oh, these guys hate Christianity or something like that.
No,
that
not at all.
Not the case. You know, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about this whatsoever if it wasn't for the faithful witness of the Christian church, the Catholic church, to deliver these scriptures to us intact, into our hands, you know, to be able to to be able to sit and meditate on these things and say, what was really going on? We wouldn't even have that opportunity if it wasn't for the historical witness of the church.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So I don't know if everyone can see this. You know, I have like a dozen commentaries on Hebrews back there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have maybe a dozen on Romans.
Yeah.
And I think probably there's someone out there is wondering, you've done Galatians, you've done Ephesians, you've done Hebrews. Romans seems to be where a lot of people hit a snag, right? So
yeah.
Is there? I have some good commentaries. I have Joe Shulam's commentary back there. But I would like. Is there ever going to be a Daniel Thomas Lancaster commentary on Romans?
I don't know. I feel like, in a sense, if you understand Galatians, which was written before Romans, if you understand Galatians, you will understand Romans and don't need a lot of help. The thing is to understand Galatians, and most people don't understand Galatians because, again, they're looking at Galatians saying, oh, Paul's saying the law is done away with.
Yeah.
So if you take that into Romans, you're lost. You will be lost.
For sure.
You know, but if you understand Galatians, you understand what Paul is really addressing, the issues he's addressing, you should be able to go into Romans without, you know, getting so lost. As you know, with God's help, I keep writing, keep teaching. This is the only thing I'm good at. I wish there was something else. You know,
yeah.
I wanted to be a
never stop.
I know. I wanted to be a rock star. It didn't work out. Yeah, I know, right? You think that's funny, but I know the truth about you too, man. You play a mean bass guitar. You play, in fact, instrument you pick up, you seem to magically know how to play every instrument on.
It's the only thing. It's the only thing I really have, Dan.
Yeah,
it's the only thing I really have.
You know, so this is what you're good at. This is what I'm good at. This is what we do is Bible teaching. You know, so as long as God gives us health, gives us years, we keep working. But Romans is not on my list, right now. I want to do Peter. I've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of work with Paul. So I want to go over and spend some time with Peter next, 1st and 2nd Peter. And as long as we're picking up 1st and 2nd Peter, we might as well pick up Jude.
Jude is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be my dream.
The weird call out to Enoch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jude is like the most apocalyptic Jewish book of the New Testament, where it's just like right in your face. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's going to be a thin book because there's not very much to Jude.
Well, but that's what I'm thinking. We'll bundle them. We'll do 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and Jude, and bundle them together. That could be it.
Well, I think everyone listening to this is going to be looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, first things first, I got to knock out this second, it's pretty much already written, but in the next 12 months, we'll have a volume 2 of Holy Epistle of the Hebrews coming out. And so this one just covers chapters 1-7. And then we'll, with God's help, we'll finish the epistle in a few months.
Yeah. First things first. I keep forgetting that it's only volume 1.
Yep.
We'll have to do another episode when you finish the other.
Yeah, right. No, I'm always good for that. Yep.
Nice. All right. I think that's all she wrote.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks for the conversation, Jacob.
Oh, absolutely. You know, anytime. Thanks for joining us today on Messiah Podcast. If you're interested in learning more about the Jewish Jesus, check out First Fruits of Zion at FFOZ.org. And if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening. Messiah Podcast is made possible by the generosity of our First Fruits of Zion friends. FFOZ friends are people like you who support our mission and get loads of exclusive Bible commentary, teaching, and content. You can join today at FFOZ.org. Tune in next time for more great conversations. Until then, I'm Jacob Franzak. Shalom. Let His word cover you and me, like the waters cover the sea. Let His love cover you and me, like the waters cover the sea.